Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And good days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York podcast.
Yes, say it with me. Welcome to the podcast. This is episode 97 of the podcast. I am Dave, your host. Thanks for listening. Today on the podcast, Joseph Mauricio, old friend of the podcast. This was a talk recorded at our weekly Dharma gathering from back in November. This is a great talk, and I'm glad you're going to hear it because it's a great talk. And Joe's a great guy, and you're gonna plug in to some meditation wisdom. But before we get to that, I do want to mention that the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York is presenting a seven-day meditation retreat. Oh my goodness, is it true? It's true. You can meditate for a week, or if you can't do a whole week, you can drop in for a day or two or three. But the Meditation Center of New York is offering a seven-day meditation retreat the last week of August, the week of August 19th. This is an opportunity to deepen your meditation practice. Many people have done this retreat in summers past, and they have spoken about being transformed, frankly, about this experience. It is certainly a unique experience and a memorable experience to meditate for an extended period of time. And to have that opportunity to do that in New York City is rare. So if you're interested, if you want to check it out, if you want to read about it, go to our website, ny.shambhala.org, and go to programs and scroll down to Urban Retreat, 7 days of mindful meditation. And now, Joseph Mauricio, he is a teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition. He is a speaker, performer, and life coach. And this was a talk recorded at our weekly Dharma gathering back in November, called Living a Brave Existence. Joe?
I think a lot of us have a very idealized idea of Buddhism, you know? You see those statues out in the woods of the Buddha, and they seem very peaceful. And they are, because they're statues. Humans have a little more conflict inherent in their existence. We have a little more difficulty sort of finding and maintaining peacefulness. But that quality of peace is so important to all of us as meditation practitioners. It's ultimately what we're trying to cultivate. I don't think there are very many people who have come to meditate to develop their meditation mind in order to become more aggressive. If you have, good luck, because you're going to become more gentle whether you want to or not. And it's really interesting because we become more gentle with meditation because we become more familiar with ourselves. When we become more familiar with ourselves, we become less antagonistic to ourselves. And we start to, in time, become comfortable with ourselves. Imagine that. And we actually start to become friendly to ourselves and start to work in concert with ourselves. And when that happens, there's a natural radiance to other people. And I think a lot of people have noticed along the way in the path of meditation, and maybe many of you have noticed this yourself, how you feel internally is kind of how you project other people on the outside. If you ever walk down the street and you judge somebody, and I'm sure nobody here has ever done that, but just stop. Next time you do it, stop for 1 second and check inside. Just check in with you. Because you might be unhappy here, right? You might be judging this, right? And it is amazing how we could walk down the street feeling overweight and unhappy and unattractive and then look at other people and go, ah, they're fat. You know? Like, just immediately start to project out difficulties that we're actually feeling inside on other people. Simply said, if we're at war with ourselves, we're going to be at war with our world. And if we want to find peace in the world, I think we have to begin here. And I think a lot of people want to change the world. And I don't blame you, because it's possible that we're headed for extinction. You know, there's only so many animals, I think, that can be on the extinct list before you see a two-legged creature up there, you know, right, on National Geographic. And we really have to begin to wake up in this culture, in this world, to begin to learn how to work in consort with the planet and with each other. But it's the position of a meditator, and meditation philosophy, if you will, that has to begin here. That the world is actually more confused by a lot of people that are trying to make it a better place. There are a lot of people running for office right now in that category. And I'm not making any judgments about that. It's just what I've seen a lot, you know? You see that a lot. In order to become known and seen, you have to become a little bit controversial. And in order to be controversial, you have to have an enemy, you know? And we all knew what actually 77 years ago was Kristallnacht, really horrible time for the Jewish people in Europe, when the Nazis actually began to round them up on that evening. It was the first time, was that 1938? The first time that the actual beginning of the persecution had happened, not just the cultural underpinnings that had always been there, but actually politically sanctioned persecution. Today is actually the anniversary of the big night when I think 20 people were killed and thousands more rounded up and sent off to concentration camps, the beginning of that. Because they were perceived to be an enemy, a whole culture of people, or were they? Or were they just an easy scapegoat so that the people in power could gain more power? You see what I mean? You even kind of wonder, really, looking back on it, if people really believe their own propaganda, or if they're just believing the story enough to be able to sell it to everyone else, in a way. I grew up in that generation where we had to hide under our desks. We had little drills, air raid drills. We had to go under the desk because the Russians were coming. I have a really good Russian friend, and we laugh about that because she was doing the same thing in Russia about the Americans coming, because we were going to come. And every time a plane flew over, my cousin Howard would go, "Those are the Russians." And I was a little boy, and we'd have to hide. And we would talk on walkie-talkies made of toothbrushes and combs. And we would be forever looking for the Russians. It was very interesting. I asked somebody once when I was a little bit older, I think I was in college at that point, we were discussing the bomb and, well, how it hadn't happened and was it going to happen. And a friend of mine who was quite astute, he actually ended up writing news copy for Bloomberg. He was very smart about events and stuff. And he said, no, the threat of war is much more valuable to people who want to be in power than the actual thing itself. That people live in fear. And when people live in fear, they're more easily controlled. And you could get them, you could rile them up, and you could tell them, you know, they need to protect the goodness of their own soil. And then they can go off to war. The Nazis in World War II, on their belt buckles, had a phrase that says, "Gott mit uns," God is with us. Or as Bob Dylan famously said, they had God on their side, as we have God on our side. And everybody thinks they're right. Everybody thinks they're right. And it's very easy for us to look at a bomb that explodes in a square or look at a plane that explodes in the sky and hate people that do that. But what are those people thinking? Do they maybe hate the people they're bombing? Or are there just cultures of evil people that wake up and think, how could we now torture the Americans? I think people believe they're right. They believe they're making a sacrifice for their goodness. The problem is they're going about it in a way that just creates more aggression. Have you ever done that? Have I ever done that? The Buddhists have a idea, so to speak, a philosophy on karma. You've heard that. And I think a lot of people in our culture, we get very easy with the phrase and kind of like, that's your karma, dude. Bad karma. Your karma ran over my dogma. All of that. But karma is really a more scientific point of view from the point of view of Buddhist thinking. It's really a cause and effect. If you do something, something happens in return. Nothing happens in a vacuum. Everything is interpenetrating. If you affect something, something else is affected down the line. The butterfly effect, you might think. In my stand-up comedy days, I used to have a joke. I'd say the butterfly effect. You know that? It's if a butterfly flaps its wings in Hawaii, there's a windstorm on the East Coast. I would say if a butterfly flaps its wings in Hawaii, I'd get angry. Yeah, I'd be in a bad mood. You know, there's a constant interpenetration of things that then we interpret as me against something else. But we don't really see how all of us are connected and how all of us kind of want the same things. They're looking for the same things for our families, for our belief systems, or maybe more perversely, just for power and money. But that happens across the board in every culture. There aren't cultures that are really, you know, kind of beyond that or above that, as far as I know. I think there are some cultures that are less inclined that way, perhaps. People talk very idyllically about Costa Rica, you know. Switzerland always stayed out of wars, but they did that by laundering mafia money. But, you know, everybody is trying to get what they can get in the world in a cynical way. And in a good way, everybody's trying to have love in the world. They're trying to protect themselves and get love in the world. So if this is a vicious world and we have to be tough to face it, if that's really the truth, right, what is the best way to be tough? Is it to be angry and violent? Because I don't think that serves anybody. And that just makes us more vulnerable to be used and manipulated. The more angry we are, the less our mind is working clearly. The less our mind is working clearly, the more we're not paying attention. And the more we're going to hurt ourselves or hurt other people. The entire Buddhist path comes down to the idea of waking up, awakenment. And the opposite of that is ignorance. And from a Buddhist point of view, or a meditator altogether point of view, we don't really look at the possibility of evil as such. There really aren't people born to just be evil, you know? Or if they are, they're actually kind of fun. But the truth of the matter is everybody has what we call in Shambhala basic goodness. Everybody has love and compassion. Everybody has the capacity for caring. They just don't have the capacity for caring for everyone. Or for seeing the big picture. Does that make sense? And sometimes that caring can be perverted into really violent, aggressive action. And sometimes, and I think you know this, against the very people you love. Domestic violence and domestic abuse. Where your love is translated into violence or anger. Or people who are just emotionally violent. Because they love so much and so deeply, you know? Do you know what I mean? These things get kind of confused for us. How do we get around the confusion? How do we create sanity from confusion? And that's the primary question of the Buddhist path. That is the primary question of the path of meditation. Actually taking the chaos and confusion of our world, the lack of clarity, the lack of understanding, and actually beginning to wake up and see what is. And one of the primary things we see in the world is that if we are not kind to ourselves, we don't have the capacity to be kind to others. And if we're not kind to others, we're not working with them, we're working against them, which makes it a hard life. And then, yes, indeed, it is a hard life. And when you talk to somebody who's struggled all their lives, and their people have struggled before that, and they've lived in struggle after struggle after struggle, it's going to be hard to convince them, dude, just meditate. We'll be okay. Because they have so much belief in the struggles, in the difficulty, in the fighting, you know? They believe it. They believe it because it's been through a kind of a heritage, an inheritance, if you will. And I think that that's the way karma works, at least the karma of violence. Somebody hit somebody, and that son hit their daughter, and the daughter hit the next son, and the next son hit the next child, and so on. And we have this kind of like constant heredity of aggression and violence, and we think that it's okay. And even if 90% of our life is good and meditating and yoga, we still have something we're mad about, and there's still the stuff we're fighting about. And maybe if nothing else, there's the places within us that we have yet to resolve or to accept or to fall in love with. Staying up too late. How many people stay up too late? How many people have made friends with that? Some people, yeah? Yeah. How many people just stay on the internet too long? How many people are okay with that? You know? And some people will be, but some people, you know, there are things that you, how many people floss regularly? I can't stand doing it. I don't know what it is, right? And it really bugs me. It really bothers me. And then you read something about how it adds to heart disease, and then you're like, oh, I'm killing myself. Why can't I do good things for me? Because I don't really like me completely, right? 25 years of Buddhist practice, or longer, I started when I was 3, but yeah, like 30 years of Buddhist, 40 years, wow, 40 years of Buddhist practice, almost coming up on that. And there's still, it's like the layers of the onion, Pema Chodron says, I'm still uncovering layers of like places that I don't like myself. It's places I'm still at war with myself. And as long as I have those, I'm going to be at war with other people. I'm going to be cutting people off at the water faucet trying to get water. I'm sorry about that. So rude. I mean, like, so rude. I, like, cut in front of, what's your name? Steven. I cut in front of Steven to get a glass of water because I was the teacher and I was late. Excuse me, get out of my way. I'm teaching meditation. Sorry, what? It's ridiculous. It happened so quick. And I was just like, what? What did you say? Well, I'll tell you, Stephen, I wasn't acting like the teacher at that point. It was crazy. You know, and that happens a lot. I'm one of these people that are like habitually like rushing to something. And it's crazy because a lot of those things I'm rushing toward is like, you know, serenity, meditation. Once I get so flustered downstairs, coming up, kind of rushing, and somebody was trying to get on the elevator behind me, and I hit the closed door instead of the open, and she had a cup of coffee, and it spilled on her, and it was like so fast, right? And I'm coming up to teach a meditation class. True story, I go to the bathroom, I comb my hair, I sit down, and she's right in front of me, right? Karma. No, I don't know. That's the abuse of karma. But in a way it is, because what happens with me, if you're interested, but I'm going to use me as an example, okay? This is just, you have your own stories, is the speed starts to come because something inside says you're not quite good enough. You got to get there a little faster. You got to be a little ahead of other people. And then what starts to happen is you start to push people out of the way or miss opportunities to just say, you first. Hi, I'm Joe, right? Miss opportunities in our life because all of a sudden we get tense and our world gets tense. And have you ever noticed that the tenser you are, the later you are, the more important you are? I mean, maybe that's not everybody. Maybe that's more like a male thing. But I mean, if I'm late, I feel like it's fine to, you know, kick baby carriages out of the way. It's not really true. That's not. But you almost think that, right? And you know, you have that you have that kind of mentality. Like just even going to the subway, like, you know, if your friend's card is out, it's like goodbye. I have to leave you. You know, we can't slow down enough to really begin to see the moments of our life and actually live a brave existence. So it's said that speed, that kind of speed, is a fundamental disregard for our existence, our experience. We're rushing through our life. What are we rushing for? You know what happens at the end, right? I want to get there quicker. Let me get there really quicker. Hook me up to those tubes now, you know. You know, it's there's nothing to rush for. There's really nothing to get. But what begins to happen is we get triggered. And when we get triggered, sometimes this reptilian brain starts to click into effect. Now, I don't believe that any human body was ever designed by whatever intelligent or non-intelligent or, you know, random design there is in the universe. I don't think anyone ever anticipated the 6 train at rush hour. You know, that's just not what our nervous system is built for, right? But we do it every day. And inside that reptile is like, rah, rah, right? By the end of the day, we want to drink a big one, you know, or, you know, we want to fight somebody or bite something, you know? It's that, like, kind of reptilian mind. Have you ever heard of attachment, right? Right, in Buddhism, that's a big word, right? Attachment, clinging, grasping, fixation, these things. And all of these things are posited generally as psychological or mental phenomena, right? Like, I'm attached to this person, or I'm so attached to my ice cream, or whatever it is, you know? What I want to introduce to you today is the idea that we actually get attached physically, that grasping happens in the body, that we actually start to squeeze our body and speed up our mind. Does that make sense? We actually start to funnel our experience down into the next thing we have to do or accomplish some kind of goal. We miss the big picture. And all of a sudden, we're right, you know? We're right. More important that we get on that train, you know? We forget that we live in a whole world that's interconnected with each of us, that peace has to do with a certain human dignity, that accepting ourselves and accepting our experience kind of means slowing down and opening up and being able to see the moments in our life, look at people, say hi, be human, you know? Here's my $14 for the Veracruz-Narrows Bridge. How are you? Good. Just anything. Instead of blaming everybody for the $14. Can you believe that? $14? Right? Or, you know, the Starbucks. I mean, how could they do the red cup thing? I don't know. To me, that's just horrible. Like, people are up in arms. They get up in arms about everything. People get agitated about everything, and there's whole talk shows discussing these things. And then there are people that are running for office that are just parlaying all of that, like getting people more agitated, right? Like, I'm not sure how many people are coming up there going, this is a way that we could all settle down and relax. This is like, no, here's a huge problem, and let's all get on board and vote for me, because I'm going to make this problem worse. You know what I mean? And that's not everybody, but it is not just Donald Trump. It's to some extent, everybody's playing that game, right, for popularity of something they're mad about, you know, right? I grew up in the punk generation. We had to be mad at everybody, everything. You know, if you weren't mad, you weren't a real artist, right? If you weren't fighting something, you weren't a real artist. And I remember I was in that studying at the HB Studios with Uta Hagen and her husband, Herbert Berghoff, who was a really angry guy. And he was, I think, fairly renowned stage actor in Europe. And he had to flee because of the Nazis' takeover. And he had to leave and came to America. And the only work he could get was playing Nazis in the movies. Which is really kind of funny, like his first five roles or something like that, playing the very people who kicked him out of his country. He never forgave anybody for it. And he was really, really difficult. But I loved him as an acting teacher because I needed that kind of thing, you know, that he had. And I remember once doing a kind of punk rock thing, a kind of loud, aggressive guy role. You've probably seen people rehearsing. Like young men in their 20s, like doing these, they're always doing tough guy things, you know, on stage, right? And I was big on that. And this was really tough and really aggressive. And I had a certain voice and stature, and so I thought, brilliant. And he goes, and I finished my whole piece, and he just looked at me and said, "What was that?" He said, "Well, that was my own adaptation of Raymond Carver, updated to..." He goes, "No, it was..." "That's what it was. You did a fart on my stage." And I said, "Really?" And he goes, "Don't disrespect me." And I was, of course, in my head, I was going, "Well, he doesn't get it. I'm an angry young man, you know, and blah, blah, blah." And then he said something brilliant. He said, "If you're so angry, make me angry with you. Make me believe your anger. Make me on your side. Then you've done something for me. Find out what it is you're angry about and get people on your side. Don't fart on everybody." But I thought that was really brilliant. And it was this idea that really is sort of struck me in Buddhism too, that we can accept everything about ourselves, including the aggression, including the anger, because if we begin to wake up, we could maybe learn how to use those things instead of divisively, but maybe as means of communication. Now, anger in its essence is probably the kind of thing that doesn't lend itself to communication. Or is it? Is it just the way we interpret it and what we do with it because we don't trust ourselves? When we get angry, we just start becoming a 3-year-old. Well, actually, either simultaneously a 3-year-old or a lawyer. Right? When we're angry. Do you ever have a fight with somebody you love? Right? And you become all of a sudden, "Well, I remember in May, you said, and then I said, and then you said," and we remember details that I would never remember in my life. When you're angry, you get really self-righteous and you get really brilliant. What if you could use that passion and brilliance, though, right, in a way that was communicative? What if you could learn to use those energies to wake up? The idea is threefold. If you could feel it in the body, that's a real good indicator of where you're going. If you're clenching your stomach, if you're tightening your neck, if you're grinding your teeth, right, you're probably not headed for open communication. There's nothing that you're doing good for yourself at that point. And actually, if somebody else is doing it to you, no. Not a meditator. We can't get away with that anymore. Once we get on that cushion, we make a covenant with ourselves to take responsibility for ourselves and wake up. Somebody else is not doing it to us. We're choosing to put that anger in our stomach. We're choosing to turn that inward and get angry and then explode out to other people. Or if that's what we do, or whatever it is we do. Meditation, and the term we use is mindfulness, gives us a sense of mindfulness about our body so we can actually gain control over the situation. Does that make sense? We actually could begin to become mindful of the body and feel it when we're going to go off the rails somehow, you know? And I'm using big examples, but they could be smaller examples. If we were to come inside and pay attention to our body, maybe get a sense of, do I need that pizza before we eat it? Or do I need that drink that maybe you don't need? that we just get carried away with all of these things in our life because of the momentum, right? We're cutting in front of somebody at the sink or whatever it is, right? We're just pushing forward and we're losing ourselves and our own opportunity to be connecting to our world and to each other. So what I want to say finally is that warriorship from the point of view of the Shambhala tradition is bravery, not aggression. And that the toggle here, the actual switch here, is between connecting or disconnecting. And that anything that disconnects us is fundamentally, can be viewed as fundamentally aggressive. Even if it's subtle, even if it's just, you know, right? Now, that doesn't mean that we have to say yes to everything and connect to everyone. We have to operate with care for ourselves, right, as a paramount thing. Because if we don't love ourselves, again, we're only going to create more problems in the world. So if we have to say no to a drink, or if we have to say no to certain friends, or if we have to say no to certain aspects of a diet in order to be able to care for ourselves, then that needs to be done. And those are moments of aggression in a way, you know? It's moments of aggression to say, no, I need to do this. But it's aggression that's being used helpfully and appropriately. Does that make sense? If somebody that you love is hurting you, or you're hurting someone you love, and it's a cycle that can't be broken, maybe the kindest thing to say is, no, no. Does that make sense? So sometimes I think it's quite appropriate to be assertive in our love. Have you ever seen that amazing little video of the mother bear pulling the baby off the highway? It's amazing. It's like this little baby is running on the highway and the mother is like on the other side of a little divider and at some point just grabs the little baby, yanks it over. And, you know, if your baby is in the highway, you're not going to go, oh, honey, come here, I love you. Mother is going to be like, boom, right? Mother is going to put the thing down. And, you know, I think the thing is that if we're doing it to connect with the world, if we're doing it to actually bring peace and love and harmony in the world, that's one thing. That's one way to look at it. But we need to be able to tell if that's really what we're doing. Does that make sense? Or if we're just actually acting out or creating more garbage. And the only way to tell is to begin to work with ourselves, become familiar enough with ourselves, to really love ourselves enough, to become really comfortable with ourselves and be able to feel the aggression inside or the hunger inside. Or the need inside, you know? If you're on a date with somebody, you know, something like that, you know, and inside checking in and going, oh my God, I'm really feeling needy. And you could ignore that, and then it's going to come out in all kinds of weird ways, you know? You know, I know it's the first date, but I really want children. You know, what? I mean, wait, what? You know, whatever it is, like, you know, it's like because we're not really checking in with ourselves and we're sort of scared of ourselves, right? Does that make sense? So just to wrap this up, I want to say if the body is tense, it's a good indicator that something isn't feeling good for you. It's not an indicator, I promise, usually, that the other person is an issue. It's an indicator that you're somehow hurting yourself in that moment, right? And if you can come back to that big open body, come back to your alignment, and come back to your balance, does that make sense? Then the appropriate thing might well be, no, goodbye, because it is that other person that is a problem, right? But as long as you're like this, we can't tell. And we're actually more likely to go on and become vulnerable and become victimized because we've made ourselves so small and so tight, you know? Or else we lash out in violence and just create more violence in the world. So the warrior is really open and relaxed. How many people have done martial arts or do martial arts? Are you ever trained to get angry? I mean, you know, or get tense and angry, or never. Yeah. Anyone? Yes. What happens when you get angry? In the context of sparring. Did everybody hear that?
No.
You lose sensitivity to the situation. Exactly that. We lose our contact to our world, including any contact with things that could be dangerous. So, you know, sometimes we give talks in Shambhala about being open, and people, if they're brave enough, will say, I live in New York. How am I going to be open on the subway? Right? What does that mean? Well, open doesn't mean you have to hug people, right? It means that you're awake and you're paying attention. When we get angry, we go into this mode. Does that make sense? We squeeze ourselves and we go down here. We're much more vulnerable then. If there's really a problem on the subway or somebody's scaring you, relaxing and paying attention is really not a bad thing to do. And tensing up and getting angry can only exacerbate situations, right? Now, is that easy to do? No. But you could practice on the cushion with yourself. Every time you see a thought and you're really stuck in the thought and you're really thinking the thought and you notice that, have the discipline to look at that for a moment before you dismiss the thought and say, I shouldn't be thinking. And just look at the whole thing and feel your body. Come back to your body. You'll begin to notice that thoughts create tension in the body. They actually create a sort of misalignment very subtly. But in our lives, what begins to happen is our body begins to become misaligned, and that gives kind of strange feedback, different feedback than we think to our universe, to our world. All of a sudden, people start going, well, they're saying all the right things, but I just don't trust this person because they don't trust themselves. Does that make sense? So the warrior is brave enough to be in the body and relaxed in the body and pay attention to themselves. Two, to take responsibility for their own feelings, right? Their own feelings. And when they feel bad, to really begin to look at that. Because as soon as we blame out there first, right, we're sort of missing the opportunity to look in here. And it may not have anything to do with out there. It might have something to do with in here. In any case, until we come in here, we can't relate to what's out there appropriate. Does that make sense?
Hi. You talk about self-love. How do you know the difference between self-love and ego?
Mm-hmm. And that's a really good question because there's a lot of old-school hardline Buddhists that hate when I say things like self-love, right? It's not that they hate, but and they have a good point because it is. What point are we? And I think it's the point of indulgence because. To me, the ego is not your friend. It wants to be, and it's trying to be, right? But it's a part of us that is really not in our best interest. One way that ego was described in a wonderful book called Myth of Freedom, if any of you have ever come across it, and by Trungpa Rinpoche, and he said it's like the general has become more powerful than the king. We're actually in kind of like a state of martial law when we get triggered sometimes in our ego, right? So that ego is by nature, these are the things that Buddhists over the years have noticed about it. You know, it's one of the things is it's never satisfied. It's never happy. So it always wants more, or it always wants something different. It always wants to change something. Does that make sense? Including yourself. So it's never really happy with ourselves. So that kind of aggrandizement that just builds that is really not helpful, you know? So that's not really being good to yourself. Does that make sense? So if you were to delineate, thank you for this question, by the way. If you were to delineate, as I've sometimes heard it said, self with a small s or self with a big s, right? Like the self that's just trying to proclaim itself and be in everybody's face, that self can actually just back off a little bit. And whatever we could do to back it off, but the best thing we could do to back it off is feel good about ourselves. When we feel good about ourselves, we don't have to aggressively proclaim our ego. Does that make sense? People who are genuinely confident, don't have to make it happen. They just radiate that. And that's the essence of the warriorship idea. Do you buy that?
Yeah.
You're still, yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I think it's just hard to tell. I mean, if you're feeling good about yourself, like, how do you know whether it's kind of a good thing or a bad thing?
Thank you. Okay. And I have, like, a personal chant for myself that is, it's going to sound strange, but it's, may I never outrun my own fear. Because when we start to forget our fear or our wounded nature or the part of us that is frightened, when we start to become, we have this bravado, we end up just in a manic state. And that state's not sustainable, and it's ultimately going to crash, right? And it could be psychologically manic, yes, but it also just could be societally manic, where we're just become the center of everything, you know?
Maybe it's feeling, it's a state of kind of feeling good about yourself, but also like noticing that vulnerability at the same time.
Exactly. Absolutely exactly.
And the non-aggressiveness.
Yes, and if you forget the vulnerability, then your chances of just becoming like a shallow, does that make sense? And this is what I mean about mindfulness of body. You start to be able to feel the difference. Like you're either in your heart or you're like kind of in your head or something.
I really appreciate you bringing this all down to kind of real life and everyday scenarios. This is my first time here. I've never meditated before. I kind of, I'm still on the fence of whether or not it's real. I came here looking for peace, and I got cut off in the water line, and I helped a pillow fall out the window, and this is all, you know, my first night here. So I also mistook friends for a couple, and there were some crystals involved. But it's okay. I mean, I have no idea what to expect.
It sounds like you're in the right place.
I don't really have a question apart from, you know, I'm just trying to figure out how meditation is going to change my life. You know what I mean? I'm trying to figure out how I take this 20 minutes sitting alone, staring into the distance, and convert that into, you know, a different, better me somehow.
Yeah.
Is that what happens here?
I like it. Can I make fun of you?
Yeah, a little.
Okay. All right. But no, because you might as well. Yeah, because you just jumped into this one today. So, but yeah, you just said you want to try to figure out how it's going to make you better. So it sounds like if you do figure it out, you don't have to do it, right? Like,
well, yeah, I could stop at some point. I'll be good.
But you know, I think it's a matter of discovery. You know, it's a matter of slowing down and synchronizing with ourselves so that we actually begin to discover what it is. I know that part of the mind that wants to have it all figured out first and know what it is. But this isn't like a religion or a cult or anything like that. I mean, it would be a cult, but it's not organized enough. We don't have any money. Like, cults have lots of money, right? Don't they? Yeah. But in all seriousness, you know, I think the Buddhist path in general, but also specifically Shambhala, is very much just more like giving us tools to be able to make our own mind up for ourselves. So it's not like a philosophy that tells you what to think as much as it helps us clarify our thinking process so we can begin to discover for ourselves, you know? Yeah. How can you be a better friend to you so that you're a better friend to your world so that your world becomes easier, more open? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, sure.
I mean, that's just one way to look at it. There's some people that are more the more old school, and you'll learn that here if you take classes here too, which is to look at ego and start to pull that apart and go, wow, this is actually not helping me at all. I think it's helping me, but it's actually keeping me locked in a set of patterns and systems in my mind. It's keeping me from growing, you know? And we begin to look at that and kind of dismantle that a little bit so that our truer self, our essential self, can kind of come forth. And one thing that is a little different in Shambhala, it's more characteristic of our school here, is this phrase we use called basic goodness. It equates to what Buddhists call Buddha nature. We just take it out of the religious context because in a way some people think of Buddha as a god and it's like my god nature or something. And basic goodness is much more ordinary. It just says that you actually are fundamentally good. And all the belief that you have to change things and fix things and make things better is this kind of like been ingrained in you, you know? If you could get back to that kid, right, that you were at one point that just saw life freshly all the time, just in love with the world, if you could get back to that, you know, life would be a much more dynamic thing. But so many of us are just stuck in patterns and life becomes a very rote and, you know, uninspiring thing instead, you know. So, yes, sir.
How you doing, Joe? How's everything?
Good.
All right. In regards to warriorship, I think that the hard part for people is it's kind of inherent in us that when we feel weak or we feel insufficient, the first thing we want to do is prove that other people are insufficient.
Right.
It's proved that other people are weak, so we somehow, in the short term, feel better about ourselves. I mean, it's real difficult and it's real uncomfortable to turn around and try to invite people in when you're feeling down. You see what I'm saying? It's difficult when you feel hurt to not judge other people, because your inherent response to being hurt is to try to prove that you're better than people, or try to prove that you're more capable than people. So I think that the warriorship part of it is kind of internal, where we have to learn to not push people away when we really need people. It's funny how when things are going good for us and things are easy for us, it's easy to invite people in, because at that moment we feel happy, we feel confident, we feel sufficient. But when we feel not those things, when we feel the opposite of those things, the first thing that we do is push people away, and we affect the personality of, God, I don't want anybody around me. I don't need anybody around me. And people see that as arrogance, and they think that when we do that, we're actually acting and feeling like we're better than them. When the truth is we feel much worse than them, but our natural response to feeling bad is to try to give the world the exact opposite of how we're feeling. So I think that the warriorship part of it is working on that and the discomfort that comes with that.
Nice. Thank you so much. That was really good. So thank you all very much. Have a great night, and we'll see you soon. Okay? Bye-bye.
Thanks, Joe. And thank you for listening. Hey, email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, limericks, jokes, riddles, anything to pass the time. Visit our website, ny.shambhala.org, for more information about classes and weekend retreats. If you happen to be in the New York City area, come see us in person. Our weekly Dharma gathering is every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear these talks live and in person. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up and tell your friends about the podcast. Enjoy your day. Later.